The Cosmic Christ, a series of talks given by Father Richard Rohr, recorded in Houston, Texas in December of 2008. This is talk number 3.
So at the top of our hourglass figure here, we have things that really are too big, too beyond, too conceptual, too abstract, too theological for the normal mind to grasp, to comprehend. They all become theories and abstractions. So the very notion of a Trinitarian God replicating himself in a set of relationships that we call creation. So that's the Imago Dei, the image of God. That if God is relational, if God is community, and that's what doctrine of Trinity is basically saying. You don't even have to think of it as a Christian doctrine. In fact, Trinity lays a better foundation for interfaith dialogue than what we have now. And I've even talked to non-Christians about this. If God is more a verb than a noun, if God is more a process than a substance, if God is more a flow than a name, I'm just grabbing for words. If God is more a relationship than an idea, which is what Trinity is saying, suddenly you can mix with people of other religions and say, you know, I can deal with that. But we pull Jesus out of the Trinity, and we can still work to unpackage this afternoon. By pulling Jesus out of the Trinity, we overplayed the Jesus card. I don't mean any disrespect to Jesus. We're going to come back to him here as very central. But you can't start with Jesus, which is what much theology has done. You got to start with creation as the mirroring and the reflection of a communitarian, relational God. Now, the reason it is so wonderful, and I mean that sincerely, to be living right now, is that physics and biology are all telling us that's true. No other century ever had access to that, to knowledge of the atom and the galaxies and the stars, and that they're all living in relationship to one another. Everything is an ecosystem, an ecology. That word wasn't even used in previous centuries. Huh? That nothing is independent. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Everything is operating in orbits to other things. Again, it's been only the human that has had the freedom or the arrogance to think that it was substantial identity by itself, apart from itself. You know, we see this mirrored in perhaps the most explicit and negative way whenever we discover a Unabomber or a terrorist who's killed loads of people or raped loads of women. Invariably, they're loners. Invariably. They're people who have sat in their own room with their own hateful thoughts years on end. And it's absolute evil because that's not who they are. And you cannot cut yourself off from intimacy, from relationship, from communion, from connection, from loving, kissing, and know who you are. You can't. You will define yourself falsely. But what I'm trying to say at this point is that notion of the human is all a reflection of the Trinitarian God. And in fact, all of creation is. Now in these wonderful shows on the Nature Channel, you'll find, you know, they pulled out one single animal and the whole ecosystem in the most strange ways. This depended on that, and once that animal was gone, this animal died, and then that grass grew too tall, and that destroyed this. It's really a piece of theology. If you study ecosystems today, how interrelated everything is. So this whole creation really is created in the image of God as relationality and fruitful relationality. So the Father gives Himself to the Son gives Himself to the Spirit gives Himself to the Father, and there is only giving. So any thought of God not loving is a theological absurdity. There is only outpouring. So you can take all those phrases in the gospel about Yahweh was pissed off and decided to smite them with his mighty hand. Sorry. That's not Yahweh. That's the Jewish people who were angry that day. Do you understand? And they want to find a reason to smite their enemies. And of course, the best justification for us being violent is to project violence onto God. And that's, I'm convinced, why the notion of a torturing God, a punitive God, has lasted down to this day. Because we almost want it. It gets us off the hook. If he smites his enemies, then history has absolute permission, and Christianity has absolute permission to do the same. You've got to begin with a clear notion of what has been clarified now in Christian history of God as an eternal, diffusive outpouring of love, one to the other, all giving and only receiving from the other, but never moving backwards. Now, again, that's probably a largely abstract concept for most people. A lot of people don't think that way, even. They're bored when you talk that way. I hope you aren't, but some people are. They say, let's get on to something interesting, you know. This became the notion of the eternal wisdom. The eternal wisdom that was eventually going to leap down from heaven. Sophia. It was a very feminine notion of God, interestingly enough. But it never moved much beyond, Jesus refers to it a couple times, but in the scriptures it's largely the book of Proverbs and the book of Wisdom that personify God as eternal wisdom, or Sophia. This becomes an abstraction, but nevertheless a wisdom or a compassionate abstraction. Then it becomes personified, it's moving into greater and greater personification or individuation with the notion of the Son of Man in the book of Daniel, which Jesus, as I said, is now going to most identify with, this archetypal, prototypal figure of a corporate personality, one who sums up the whole. We can't get big pictures like this. We have to look at one person. We're still that same way. You can talk about love all you want, till you fall in love with one little child, one husband, one wife, you don't know what love is. It remains all an abstraction until it becomes concrete and personal. Now that is for us the meaning of Jesus. That the second person in this flow that we call the Son, one part of the flow of God without the flow of God ceasing, became flesh. In the most humble, invisible, still unbelievable way. When you think about it, you say, how can we believe it? I remember the first time I visited Nazareth, and they took me to they think in his lifetime it might have been 150 people, maybe 200, and that all the houses were just little lean-tos into caves. And then they found the one where all these carvings were on the wall, and we Franciscans built a great big basilica over it, which we assume was the little house of Mary and Joseph. And I remember walking out and the dust blowing in my eyes and the sun being glaring, and it was just still a pretty non-impressive town. And I said, and I'm supposed to believe that this became that in this little podunk town. I really have based my whole life on that. It's sort of beyond comprehension what we believe, that the eternal God. I remember when that same Jewish friend in Cincinnati said to me so sincerely, he said, you don't really believe that, do you? He said, that God became a human being and urinated and defecated and had a penis? Come on. And, you know, I've got to put it to you with that kind of scandal to get, do you believe that? That's what we Christians came to believe, yeah. But we covered up the penis on the cross whenever we could because it became too scandalous for us, all right? No, he doesn't really have a penis. He's not that human, you know. And, of course, we had to make him a virgin and Mary a virgin and every way to disconnect them from embodiment. So it's so strange that embodiment is the source of our scandal. It's your bodies that carry your shame. If you want to shame somebody, catch them on a sexual sin. Greed doesn't matter. Arrogance doesn't matter. Deceit doesn't matter. I mean, look at our presidents. Doesn't matter at all. You can do all those things. You can kill people. Doesn't matter. But if you fool around, all right, we gotcha. All right? And it works. It works. Because you've got to know that's where human beings carry shame. About being sexual and embodied and physical. And you see women especially prone or move toward this with their force to be obsessed with their body shape, their thinness, that they often carry their shame that they're too fat, they think, you know. That fat body itself is somehow bad, evil, no good. If you want to shame a woman, make fun of her weight. I mean, that doesn't make a bit of sense. She can be proud and arrogant and righteous. She'll put up with that, but don't let her be fat. We don't like embodiment, you see? Really stupid when you think. And I'm trying to make it a caricature. I'm trying to make it stupid, because it is. But my point is that if any religion should have been able to address that, it should have been Christianity. But we didn't. We're the only religion that believes this became physical, became material. It was the solving of the great problem for creation. This shame about the limited state of creation, the death of all creation, everything in the physical world transmutes into different states of air and ice and oxygen and water and solids. Nothing stays the same. And this constant falling apart of everything physical, including these bodies of yours and mine, is our great fear, is the great defeat, the great disappointment, the great sadness, that we can't maintain it. We can't perpetuate anything in a constant state, that it's all changing. Now, our word for that, the religious word for that, is the Paschal Mystery. Peshach in Hebrew means the Passover mystery, that everything must go through. Now, I like this image of a hourglass, because what you see here is coming to greater and greater constriction. That there's the loss of these great universal notions. There's what's called in Philippians the great kenosis. He emptied himself. He emptied himself and became like all things human are, in fact became humbler yet, became like a slave, as Philippians puts it. So Jesus for us becomes the pinpoint in history that personifies the mystery, exemplifies the mystery, patterns the mystery, and reveals the mystery. And we fell in love with it. We really did. For 2,000 years, this worshiping of the revelation of the heart of God, the revelation of this eternal mystery that was too big for our minds to comprehend. It's interesting that in our time, because of microscopes and telescopes, when we finally can look at some of this bigger creation, we're getting a handle on understanding it. It's at this same time that we seem most ready to now move the hourglass back out into the big picture. That the point was not to get you to simply worship Christ, or worship Jesus, excuse me. Jesus was the revelation. But what we did for the most part is substitute the messenger for the message. And the worshiping of the messenger, in great part, became, on the practical level, an avoiding of the message. We didn't have to listen to the Sermon on the Mount. We didn't have to have him really as our teacher, our guide, who said, follow me and do the same thing I did. We don't have to do anything you did, Jesus. We're just going to worship you. And for some reason it works. It really does. I don't know what the trade-off is for the ego or the psyche. But I know in my own little way I've experienced it. Some people who make an idol of me or put me on a pedestal, I'm always very disappointed when that happens. First of all, because I know I'm going to eventually fall from it when they see how ordinary and human I am. But secondly, and I've seen this again and again, very often the admiring of me, the quoting of me, the talking about me is done most by people who don't really live it at all or like it at all. Or I'm sure I'm not applying this to you, but who it just becomes this love affair with the one who brought you the message. Do you understand? And that feels, for some strange reason, like following the message. And it works. I don't know why. Now, this constricting, and I want to spend a little time on this, is mirrored then in our own kenosis, our own self-emptying, our own moving out of the huge world of concepts, ideas, theories, and theologies, where I really believe most of Christian history has been fighting about this stuff. How to formulate it? Is it true? Do I agree? Do I like it? That has been most of Christian history. That's what each of us has to finally die to. Our theories, our theologies, our glorified self-image, our superior self-image, each of those is a dying to the self, to what you think you are, till you get down to the same emptiness that Jesus was. Now, we would say the method for doing that is called contemplation, where you act as a third-person observer, watching your own dramas, your own theater pieces, your own attachments, your own angers. And as I said to one of you a little bit ago, once you do that, you recognize that you basically entertain a negative or paranoid something almost every 30 seconds. Something you're irritated by, angry at, want to change, want to fix, want to deny, want to expose, want to eliminate. This is the nature of the human beast. And if you don't see that pattern, why would you let go of it? You don't even realize how much you're possessed by it, how much it's blotting your vision and blocking your vision. So this is the self-emptying that Jesus went through that is then mirrored in us. So it's the death experience that for him was facilitated on the cross. And his cross is his most dramatic way of saying, you're all going to have to die to who you think you are, to who you really are. For the Jesus to move to the Christ, there is a death involved. So maybe that's a good interpretation of the fear and trembling passage. Nobody gets off the hook of this. That there, and this is the task of much of the middle of life. I mentioned to you earlier that all these people, like Don Beck, Claire Graves, Ken Wilber, Kohlberg, Fowler, Piaget, Bill Plotkin, they all seem to be these coming up with these scenarios of maturity. Some have six stages, some have seven, some have eight. The levels of faith, the levels of morality, the levels of consciousness, they call them different things. But the amazing thing they all seem to agree upon, each in their own language, is that the only way you move from one to another is through a necessary period of death and darkness. And I want to take a few minutes to describe that, because this has not been described for most people, and that's why they don't know how to get across it. Because when the darkness comes, they think they've done something wrong, or God has abandoned them, or they've lost all motivation and they just give up. Whatever game you're playing, and you can use any of those scenarios you want of descriptions of stages, whatever game you're playing has to start not working. It has to start not being successful for you anymore. It's not giving you the payback that you were used to. The things I used to do to feel loved and special and famous, they don't work anymore. Do you understand? That has to happen. Now, if you're not taught how to endure that period, it might be days, it might be weeks, usually it's months of disorientation, of wandering in the desert, of not knowing who you are, not being very motivated, not even sure you believe in God. You understand? You stop praying. It's like, oh God, do I believe all that stuff anymore? You know, that's what we call in men's work liminal space. It's what John of the Cross would call the dark night of the senses. Only a certain one is the dark night of the soul. But I'm just calling it where your senses don't satisfy you like they used to. Now, if you don't have a wise teacher or a good spirituality that teaches you how to hold on during that period, how to continue to believe even though there's no satisfaction to it, no joy in it, it's bare-knuckle belief. Well, I guess you're still out there. I think maybe I love you, but I'm not even sure. I do. I guess this is a coherent world, but it sure doesn't feel like it. But I don't become cynical, or I don't go back to the old game. Now, most people, because they can't endure that period of darkness, they go back to trying to run even harder at the old game. Now, that's why, like in Bill Plotkin's 8th stage, he says most of America is at best stage 3. In an 8th stage section of scenario of maturity. Because who's going to tell you that there even is such a thing as stage 4? And in fact, what most of these teachers agree with is that the best you can understand on a good day, if you're, let's say you're a stage 3 person, on your best day, you can perhaps understand a stage 4 person. But 4.5 and 5, they just look nuts. Right? They're crazy. They're out of it. They're heretics. They're sinners. That's why Jesus was killed. He was a stage 8 person. I mean, stage 3 people, he's dangerous to religion. He's dangerous to the empire. That's why all the prophets were killed. Do you see? Now, that doesn't mean just because people hate you, you're a higher stage person. Don't judge there. They might hate you because you're just neurotic and bothersome. And some people will make that jump. Oh, yes, everybody hates me. I must be stage 8. You know, maybe. Now, we need much more teaching on a spirituality of darkness, on a spirituality of living with the contradictions, of living with paradox, with mystery, of the dark night. There were two major traditions in spirituality. You don't need to remember these words, the cataphatic tradition and the apophatic. You see them strongly in the scriptures. Let me give you two images of them, both the transfiguration symbol on Tabor and the Sinai experience with Moses. You'll see in both cases there's a revelation where God seems momentarily to show God's face. And in both cases, on Sinai and Tabor, it's immediately covered with clouds. Right? There's the seeing balanced by the not seeing. Now, the seeing tradition is called the cataphatic tradition, where you know God through concepts, ideas, words, theories, theologies, sacraments, and Bibles. That tradition, pretty much since the medieval mystics, has totally taken over. Right? It's all about knowing and being certain. That's why we have fundamentalism, right? For overplaying the certitude card, the knowledge card, I know and I'm certain card, for at least the last 500 years. So fundamentalism, in my opinion, is the low point of Western religion. And it's the same thing happening in Islam, in Judaism, there's even fundamentalist Buddhists, believe it or not, right? Where you so need certitude, and you were told you have a right to certitude, which is terribly inflating to the ego, terribly dangerous to the ego, to think you've got the truth. You know that quote that fundamentalists most use, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." The point of that is saying, "I am, therefore you're not," you see? But all these Christians, "Oh, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life." And the big assumption there, the big missing gap, is that you've got Jesus. That you think the same as Jesus does. What an arrogant assumption. That your mind is equal to the mind of Christ. He is the way, the truth, and the life, which means I'm not and you're not. It takes away from all humanity this arrogance about I've got the truth. That's what happens after 500 years of almost, except in a few remaining mystics, losing the parallel and balancing tradition called the apophatic tradition. And this was knowing God through emptiness, through darkness, knowing through not knowing. Now, you've all heard this line many times, but I'm repeating it not as a cliche, but as a piece of wisdom. It's really true that people who know that they don't know. That's what it means spiritually to know, right? You know that you don't know, that you've just, you know, nudged the edge of the truth at best on your best days. We don't have that humility anymore in either Catholic or Protestant or Orthodox Christianity, because we have 500 years of non-contemplation, non-mysticism, all cataphatic, no apophatic, no even teaching. My next book that's supposed to come out September 1st is called The Third Eye. And I feel at least one, maybe two, of the initial publishers who asked for it then said, no, I don't think it's going to sell, you know. So another publisher is going to sell. And they wanted a big seller. Of course, they're in trouble too. But I really understand why they're saying that. Because what I'm trying to do is much more teach the wisdom of not knowing. And in a capitalist culture, that doesn't sell. You understand? Everything is about having certitude as a product, as a conclusion, as an ego investment. I know. And we've been told we have a right to think that. We, the very people who were told we were saved by faith. Now, isn't that ironic? I mean, you know what the word faith means. It means not knowing. How did we, against all odds, against all expectations, against all teachings of the Old Testament and the New Testament, succeed, largely after the Enlightenment, to turn around the notion of faith to mean the exact opposite of what it really means? I would call it the single biggest heresy in the Western Church. And it's pervasive. That we really think we have a right to certitude and a right to knowledge. There is no humility before mystery. There is no patience with mystery in ourselves, in others, and in God. That's a very violent universe. When you think you have a right to an answer to everything, and therefore you include, I do know, and you don't know, and I'm right and you're wrong. That's the contentious society we live in today. And that's what leads us to the kind of hate radio and hate politics that we take for granted. I can't believe some of the mainline commentators on CNN and network that in former ages, those would have been called sort of stupid people. To be ranting and raving and putting down other people and mocking other people. And we tolerate them as mainline commentators. Because that's the level of adolescent conversation in an adolescent culture. You mock and make fun of things because you don't know how to do reasoned argument or intelligent conversation. So you have to use sarcasm, which is the lowest point, the lowest level of human communication or human comedy. It was amazing how much it was even in the election. At any rate, we have to return to the balancing of knowing with not knowing. That is a contemplative journey. That is a journey of letting go of my false certitudes, my self-image, my superior opinion about everything. It's a lot of dying. And if someone isn't going to guide you in that or teach you how to do that, how would you know? How would you know that it's even expected? I mean, I came out of the seminary still thinking my job was to have as much knowledge and certitude about as many theological opinions as possible, because I was a priest now. You know? It actually did not prepare me to be a spiritual guide at all. Right? It prepared me to for priestcraft, but not really to be a spiritual guide. We have to do the same kenosis. Are you familiar with that word kenosis? It's used by a lot of teachers. K-E-N-O-S-I-S. It's the Greek word for self-emptying. When you sit down, like we do in the morning for our contemplative prayer, it's basically sitting down for 20 minutes of dying. 20 minutes of dying to yourself, your own opinions, your own thoughts, your own feelings about everything. Most people just won't do it because they think they are their thoughts And who would I be without them? I was impressed at that church at Christ Church Thursday night that people stayed there for 20 minutes of silence. And a lot of them were humble enough to admit it was pure torture. Pure torture. We live with this body our whole life, but to live without our thoughts is to like to die, to live without me. I don't know who I am without my thoughts, not realizing that most of them are self-serving, compulsive, obsessive, and paranoid. The primary addiction we have is to ourself and to our way of thinking. If you can constrict and make the same movement into the incarnation, the transfiguration experience through the revelation and the darkness of Jesus, then you can return as history returns as the Christ. So to repeat it one more time, Jesus was not born as the Christ. Christ is not his last name. A transfiguration, a morphing, a realization had to take place even in Jesus before he became the anointed one that in which everything else cohered. That I quoted earlier in Colossians and Ephesians, most especially, and in the prologue to John's Gospel. Everything cannot cohere if we got to pull people inside of our explanations. So the resurrected Christ is the Christ. So when you speak of the risen Christ, you're really not speaking of Jesus anymore. I understand that correctly. It is Jesus, but it's now bigger than Jesus. It's beyond Jesus. It's Jesus released from any space-time restriction whatsoever. He is beyond space. He is beyond time. He includes all of the physical and the spiritual world and reconciles it together within himself. He is God's solution summed up in one moment, the risen Christ. So you got to go through the whole Paschal mystery, the whole Passover experience, the ascended Christ. I remember going to an art museum in Madrid, and there's that picture. It's often been, at least in Catholic art, and it's sort of a surprising picture because it's a huge painting, but most of the pictures, the 12 apostles all looking upward. And just in the very top of the painting, you see Jesus' feet. And it's supposed to be, of course, the ascension. And they're all looking up. And the word is, of course, the name of it is, why are you looking up? Go ahead into Galilee. But most of religion has been looking up at his feet, all right, trying to find the historical Jesus. Where'd he go? You know, rocket ship Jesus, we call the Feast of the Ascension. And then, of course, that three-level universe held on. So when the Russians go up in Sputnik, they say, well, we went up there and he's not there, right? You see the problems it got us into. As long as we stayed in a three-level universe instead of one universe that is all supernatural, that is all transmuted and transformed by the glory of God. He didn't go anywhere. He told us that this is where it was at. You see? That's why the final chapter of the Bible promises us a new heavens and a new earth. Well, we sure haven't been expecting that new earth the way we've been polluting it, destroying it, killing it at the rate we have in the last century. No century has destroyed the planet the way this one single century has. Thinking we have endless rights. Why would we not? When there's been no kenosis teaching, no self-emptying, no letting go, no spirituality of subtraction. It's just people who have loads of certitudes about why they're going to heaven. How? I ask you honestly, how will that ever help the world? How will that ever save the world? Creating smug, self-satisfied people who are sure that they're going to heaven and usually that you're not. This is a recipe for violence, is a recipe for greed, selfishness, and exactly what we've got. So the ascension is the image not of the going back to the other world, but that the two worlds are one. That he who was among us is making heaven and earth one world. So this is the mystery that we call the Christ. Whenever the human and the divine coexist and cohere, we have the Christ. That includes the physical world, the natural world, the animal world, the sacramental ritual world, which is why I mentioned the Eucharist, that we need still repetitions of this Jesus mystery in condensed form. I think a seeing person will get the same experience, perhaps by visiting the bed of a sick friend or a poor family that's still totally joyful and in love. That's a sacrament too. So I don't mean by speaking of the bread and the wine to say that's the only sacrament. It's a clarified form of it. But the point is to see the same thing at the hospital and in the hovels of the poor and in those who are disfigured and eliminated and expelled, that they are all images of the ongoing crucifixion of God, the ongoing rejection of the message of love and communion. So I don't know if that geometric image helps at all. I sort of hope it does. In many ways, the main reason I gave it was simply to illustrate the processing, the staging, that you don't move from Jesus to the Christ without death and resurrection. And you don't move from your independent historical body to the Christ consciousness without a lot of letting go, right? Of who you think you are, who you think you need to be, who you think you need to be better than, all those ego games. We're well trained in them. We have to let go of each one of them to be the naked self before the naked God. That I am who I am, who I am, and this naked little undecorated Richard is already and forever the beloved Son of God. I mean, when that moment hits you experientially, you'll be free. That's when your Christian life begins, and that's when you move, as Jesus did, from Jesus to Christ. When you move from your momentary, tiny identity to who you thought you were for 40 years. I'm a white American Protestant with this kind of education and this career, living in this part of Houston and making this much money, right? You are none of those, right? You better know who you are apart from that, or you got nothing when you die. That doesn't mean anything in the eternal spheres. Those are simply the containers inside of which we discover the mystery. They're not the contents. Got it? They're the containers. Your job is your container. Nothing more. I worry about so many men who are so overly identified with their job and don't have a clue who they are. And inside of that, they just try to keep getting promoted, earning more money. That's an example of going back to the earlier stage and doing it faster. You understand? As the addicts say, doing more and more of what doesn't work, right? Just run faster and faster because I don't know how to endure the darkness and go on to stage 4. No one's told me there is a necessary darkness or a necessary letting go. Now, in that period of darkness, what you tend to see is if you're looking, if you're listening, if you're not running backward, as so many people do, to prop up the old system, prop up the old system, what you're learning is the futility of most of us. Even though you've got to do it. You understand? You all had to get your education. Good for you. That's the necessary building of the boundaries, of the container. You had to get your first career and make some money so you could marry a wife and raise some children. But that's not you. It doesn't mean anything. That's going to all pass away. You've tried to create your own superiority by thinking, because you have white skin, this makes you better than some other people. That's going to die. That doesn't mean anything. That skin's going to deteriorate in a few days, and you better know who you are apart from the color of your skin. Isn't it unbelievable that we haven't taught our people this? That they don't know this? That people who go to church every Sunday are entirely invested in the false self. So those of you who've heard our work on the true self, false self, that's another way this all overlaps. This is the death of the false self and the opening up and the exposure to the true self. What we call initiation is simply teaching this process very clearly and experiencing it. Rites of passage are whatever events in your life force you through this channel to let go of your illusions. Great suffering, great love can do it positively too. Because when you really love someone else, you actually care about them for a while more than yourself. You would actually value their life more than your own. And you certainly understand that with your children. I hope you even understand it with your spouse, that you care for them so much. You would take on pain rather than have them suffer more, whatever it might take many different shapes. So the true self is who you are, hidden with Christ in God. The false self is the first half of life, almost entirely created by fictions, fabrications, labels, roles, identities, titles, superficial forms, what you wear, the shape of your body, what group you belong to. I brought a book on the plane that I just started, but it's called Us and Them. This is a social psychologist, and he's just taking all of history and showing how the identity for most people who've ever lived on this earth has been created socially by identification with a group, and then trying to exalt that group by demeaning another group. And when you read it, just page after page, you say, how could we be so stupid? Well, when you don't have a spiritual life, when you don't have inner experience, what most people do is they substitute group identity for personal identity. You see? I don't know who I am in God, which is so solid, so abundant, so gracious, so good, that you're home free. But if you have never had any experience of your true self in God, and God in you, you'll grab at your Czech identity. I'm Czech. I'm Czech. Czechs are the best. Czechs make the best food. Czechs, you know, well, Czechs are nice, but so are Italians, you know. Of course, the Italians are doing the same thing, you know. And honestly, just read a history book. This is what the poor little boys of all of history have died for. These nation-state identities that became a substitute for their own identity. And it is still happening in our day. And I suspect it would only increase as we have such a superficial culture that boys will seek false initiation, go off to join the military or any group. I don't know who I am, but the group will tell me who I am. And the group gives me my journey because I don't have a clue how to walk on the journey. That's what we are in a society without mentors, without elders. As we say in our men's work, we have elderly people in our culture, but we don't have a lot of elders. And it's not even their fault, because even though they've been around 60, 70 years, no one taught them how to pass over, how to let go and come out alive on the other side. This is what Paul calls the freedom of the children of God. This is what Augustine calls love God and do what you want. Wow. Don't you wish someone had told you that when you were 17? Huh? Love God and do what you want. He was saying that to mature people. But what he's trying to describe is the freedom of this stage. But do note, that freedom, although you will hold it responsibly and with deep inner values and criteria of what your life means and what your soul is telling you, to outsiders, it will be interpreted as license, as libertinism, as dangerous freedom, as heresy. Do you understand? Because you've met the formless. Once you've met the formless, you can't be obsessed with forms anymore. You can use them, do you understand? But I'm not going to fight over them. I'm not going to think they really matter. The example I always use for Catholics, you know, we dress in liturgical colors. Like Advent, we just switch to purple or blue, and we wear green. And oh, some people will report you to the bishop if you wear the wrong color. I was reported twice in Cincinnati. Richard is not wearing the correct colors, you know? This is all you have to worry about. When you haven't met the formless, you will try to keep stronger and stronger. And I'm sure you could apply this each to your own denomination. These people just waiting in the wings to catch you on something you've done wrong. Huh? Now we have in our church that only the priests can wash the sacred vessels. Well, for 30 years have all these lay people been sinning? We've been washing the vessels for 35 years. Suddenly, God has changed God's mind. I don't think God changed God's mind at all. I think some Monsignor in Rome changed his mind. And all of us have to suffer because of it. Because you can even, and I'm not trying to be negative about the clergy, but you can be ordained at high levels and still not have gone through this Passover. You understand? In fact, if the seeking of ordination and ministry state is a career move, and it often is, you can almost be assured that you're not going to pass over. That to join the clergy is an up in social advancement. You understand? It's more social status, more social praise, quite comfortable lifestyle, usually. So unless you somehow find a way, as my Father Francis did, to identify with the poor, to go out to those who are marginalized, you'll basically forget about them, right? You won't know that that's most of the world is poor and that most of the world is suffering. And this is not, I'm starting with the clergy, but this has happened to these country club churches, which I might add your state is famous for, creating churches that seem to be disconnected to the social problems of our world, are not even interested in the social problems of our world. It's just this feel-good Cadillac faith about how we're noble and wonderful and going to heaven. And I can understand it. In a way, it really is, I'm going to try to be fair, it's people who had a little taste of their Christ consciousness and the abundance of it and the beauty of it, you understand? And they get all excited about this abundance and beauty, and they offer it to people without the Passover, without the Paschal mystery, without the transformation. So there's really no renewed consciousness. There's really no transformed state. There's no love of the poor. There's no love of the outsider. There's still usually high level of purity codes that exclude the sinner, the homosexual, whoever isn't like me. And that's passed for religion ever since the time of Jesus. In fact, these are the folks who give Jesus the most trouble. But here's the amazing thing, is that Jesus puts up with it. And I want to say that. That's your cauldron of transformation. That the people who should love you and should understand very often are your worst enemies. And this is even true in our natural families, isn't it? Sometimes the people who are the hardest for us are the people we thought we would love the most, and have hurt us the most. That's almost the norm. But just as it's true in the natural family, it is true in the spiritual family too. Who was it? One English saint of the last century, I forget, said, who would have ever thought that the church itself would have been the primary cross that Christ was crucified on? That the church crucifies Christ more than anything else by pretending to believe his message but largely opposing it when it comes to anything practical, anything real. Just keep the theory and the theology up here, and then you sound orthodox, you sound highfalutin and superior, but never go through the great constriction, the great death, the great not knowing, the great darkness, the great Passover. Use whatever word you want. Now, as some of you know, we give these five-day rites of passage. There's about eight men here who went through it. But I always say to them on the last day, I think this is a wonderful experience, and they know it is. But in fact, you don't have to go through CAC's males program or rites of passage. If you're listening, now a lot of people aren't. If you're aware, a lot of people aren't. Most people aren't. Life will initiate you anyway. You see, I mean, your game will fall apart. I hate to have to tell you that, all right? Unless you're extremely wealthy and extremely good at denial. If you're extremely wealthy and extremely good at denial, you can't avoid the Paschal mystery. You won't really. Inside, you'll be rotting, but you won't even have the sense to know that. that you're dying inside, because you don't know what love is or life is, so you don't know what death is until you've experienced life, you see. So a lot of people who are dying don't know they're dying. They actually think they're happy because they've never experienced the alternative state. You follow me? But life will initiate you. And my job here as a teacher is primarily to tell you is when it falls apart, when it doesn't work, when the darkness shows itself, you are being transformed, if I can put it this way, for our purposes today, you are being transformed to Jesus, from Jesus to Christ. You're going through your own passion, death, resurrection, and ascension, and putting heaven and earth back together. But this seems to be the price. It doesn't just happen in your head. It doesn't happen by studying seminary courses or something like that. It's a life journey. So as one of you, was it you, Jeff, quoted to me, my quoting of Paula D'Arcy, God comes to you disguised as your life. Once you hear that, it's obvious. How else would God come to you? And they did us a terrible disservice by saying God comes to you through sacraments and Bibles and priests and ministers. Maybe we sometimes succeed in not getting in the way. And sometimes we facilitate the journey. But I want to say it as strongly as I can. Primarily, God comes to you disguised as your life. That's the agenda. And what your life is going to offer you, and I know on the day when it comes, when it's something you hadn't hoped for or waited for, it won't feel like God. But I've got to tell you ahead of time, that is the great Passover. You won't be able to engineer it. You won't be able to force it in one direction. It will feel like dying. It will feel like losing. It will feel like letting go, just like it did for Jesus on the cross. But we are not helping people not to tell them about this ahead of time. And that's all we can really do. And I think the final phrase of the Our Father, deliver us from evil. I've struggled for years. What did he mean by that? My only thing I can come up with, he's saying, deliver me from, when that day comes, from being totally unprepared, right? Because if you have had no spiritual preparation when the bottom falls out, and it's going to happen for a lot of our people in the next 12 months, you will despair. You will become harder than ever. You will look for somebody to blame. You will hate yourself or even become suicidal because you will feel like you're such a failure. Religion, as many of you have heard me say, is primarily about what you do with your pain. And that's why we worship a painful, wounded man, because this is the central issue. And I don't think the Catholics were all wrong in hanging the crucified in the center of most of our churches. Because sooner or later, we're all there. And when you're there, you'll be real happy to see that Jesus is there too. You won't feel so isolated. You won't feel so abandoned. And you'll know this is the agenda. What are you going to do with your pain? The fact that we have so much unprocessed pain, and we have so many people passing on their garbage. I mean, you saw that thing in the morning news, this little teenage boy chained up naked by his parents. Thank God he escaped. You know, starved to death, you know. It's like, how are human beings capable of this? Well, if we went back, I'm sure his mom and dad had a lousy life too. That doesn't make what they did right. But no one would be that hateful to their own child or another human being unless they were harboring a lot of untransformed hurt, a lot of abuse, a lot of self-hatred. And it hurts so much, apparently, when you're carrying it around. Maybe you face depression, some of you, that eventually what you do is you have to project it somewhere else. I can't keep carrying this. And you don't even mind making someone else suffer. It's called a masochist. And we have a lot of masochistic behavior of passing on our hurt. We see our young people doing it by this gashing of themselves. And I couldn't understand that. Why would anybody, you know, people like you and me who try to avoid all pain, and you see people, these young kids, And I saw them in the jail in Albuquerque with gashes all over their arms, self-inflicted. And we finally, best we can figure out, is when the pain is amorphous and constant. And it's just, I don't know how to get out of my own body. I don't know how to get away from myself. For some reason to focus it and just worry about these 2 inches for the next 3 days is actually a lessening of the pain. Don't you just want to cry that people are hurting that much? You know? That to cut themselves and obsess on that, but then I don't have to feel all of this. I mean, it has its own kind of logic, but what sad logic. And for me, because I'm always looking at things from the viewpoint of religion, it tells me, brothers and sisters, that religion hasn't been doing its job very well. That we have so much untransformed pain. And that this country with Christian churches everywhere, it's not like we were the minority religion here. This was the country that called itself Christian and apparently did not get the message. Its message was largely belief in theoretical ideas. I just keep pointing to the top of this. And the defending of theoretical ideas and proving that my theoretical ideas are better than your theoretical ideas. Who cares, you know? But no one wants to go. And Jesus almost foretold this. Remember the 3 times in Mark's Gospel, Matthew's 2, where he tells the apostles, you're going to have to follow me to Jerusalem. We're going to be killed. We're going to be disgraced. And all 3 times they say no. There is the prophecy of what happened in history. We don't want to go through the channel, through the transformation, through the Paschal mystery. So I hope I didn't take too long on that. But unless I make that point clear, you could leave here thinking that I'm saying a glib message of everything is beautiful. You understand? Now, I do think everything really is pretty beautiful down here, right? It is. But it's because at this stage, you found the capacity to hold the pain, to enter into solidarity with it, not to fear it or hate it or project it onto other people. You understand? You've become an agent of transformation. A transformer, not a projector. You hold the mystery. Well, it's really God holding it in you, because the little self can't do it. But God in you can absorb it, can forgive it, can resolve it. And I know many of you have been to that place where I really don't need to hate her anymore. I really don't need to punish him anymore. And I'm surprised myself. Where did it go? For 10 years, I just wanted to get him. I just wanted to make him feel what I had to feel. And why is it? I wake up on February 22nd and I don't need to anymore. You know it's grace. You know someone else is holding you, living through you, with you, in you, in spite of you, for you, and your life is not your own henceforward. Your life is not your own. You henceforward draw from the Christ mystery, the Christ nature, the Christ source. Now you regress, you fall back into your hurts and your false self, probably 10 times a day. But once you've experienced your true self, who you are in Christ, you can't believe this anymore. Do you understand? It's not satisfying. It's not real. This is the real. Now, people who've never experienced the really real, they think this is the real, because that's all they've ever experienced. They're still in stage 3. They think stage 5 is ridiculous or impossible.
For more information on other books and recordings by Father Richard Rohr, call the Center for Action and Contemplation Resource Center at 505-247-1636 or visit the center's website at cacradicalgrace.org.